Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for being with me. Hey, we're here in Baltimore still at the Fall Assembly. It's an annual event. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meet. We're here in Baltimore. And this, of course, was a much-awaited assembly. Yesterday, there was bombshell news that the Vatican insisted on delaying a vote on the abuse policies that the bishops were planning on thrashing out today and voting on tomorrow. So now what had been action items have become discussion items. We're going to be talking about that today because there is much to talk about. And Chris White will be joining us. Chris is national correspondent for The Tablet and Crux. We will be taking a look at why the Vatican delayed votes on addressing abuse. And just again, trying to get a feel for what's gone wrong here. I'm not sure we're going to nail anything down. Let me make that clear. But we are exploring it, and I think right now that's the only thing we can say with integrity, that we're exploring what's happening. Also coming up today, Ed Condon from the Catholic News Agency, helping us understand better this whole situation. Monsignor Charles Pope will be with us, taking a look at the first chapter of Titus, St. Paul's letter to Titus, one of what's called the pastoral epistles. And in the first chapter of Titus, St. Paul lays out the qualifications for a bishop, what the New Testament expects of a bishop. We'll talk that over with Monsignor Pope. Matthew Bunsen will be giving us an update on the discussion among the bishops today. And Father John Trigilio will reach back to his long experience as a priest, the Diocese of Harrisburg. He's also director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary Seminary. He is also head of the Congregation for Catholic Clergy. And I'll ask him, how did we get to this situation? But first, to the news headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, November 13th. It's the feast of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano sent a message today to the fall meeting of the USCCB, encouraging to act as courageous shepherds in the face of the sex abuse crisis. In part, he instructs the bishops to meditate on Proverbs 9:10, which states, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." It was intended that the assembly would vote on proposals meant to form the basis for a response to the sexual abuse crisis facing the church in the U.S., but Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, president of the conference, announced Monday morning that the Congregation for Bishops has directed that the vote not be held. Fire crews are aggressively attacking Southern California's Woolsey Fire today.
They're going to be attacking this fire, especially in the Malibu area, from the air. That they have dozens of aircraft that have been brought in from other states, including as far away as Texas and as far up north as Seattle, Washington.
Reporter James Rojas is nearby and says firefighters are getting frustrated while battling the flames with the high winds. Right now, the Woolsey Fire has charred 96,000 acres and is 35% contained. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up a Virginia redistricting case on racial gerrymandering. The court has agreed to hear an appeal filed by Republican lawmakers following a lower court's ruling that 11 House of Delegate districts must be withdrawn. Federal judges found the districts were drawn based on race and were unconstitutional. Amazon is confirming it will split its new headquarters between Arlington, Virginia and New York City. More than two dozen metropolitan areas hope they would be chosen. Amazon says it would invest $5 billion and 50,000 new jobs between the two headquarters. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta here in Baltimore, Maryland, at the annual fall assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And in the run-up to this fall meeting, there was great expectation that the bishops would be formulating, having big debate and formulating some policy on dealing with clerical sexual abuse that has once again dominated discussion of the Catholic Church in the United States. Instead, what happened was an instruction from the Congregation of Bishops said, don't come up with any policy. Wait until February when we do a global look at this. And I want to talk about this. With me right now is Chris White. Chris is national correspondent for Crux and The Tablet, and he's been writing on this. He's here. It's good to have you with me, Chris.
Great to be with you, Al.
Let me just lead with this. A multinational corporation that has to deal with a problem has spent months getting its top leaders together. There's a lot of publicity about it. People are expecting something to be done. And then at the last, at the 11th hour, some chairman of the board steps in and says, don't come up with a conclusion. That would be considered humiliating. It'd be considered a slapdown. It would be considered terrible public relations. It would be considered a sign of incompetence and a refusal to plan ahead. It's not as though the bishops were meeting covertly or they hadn't published on this before. As an observer of Catholic Church polity and policy, what sense do you make of this?
Well, it's hard to imagine, say, Tim Cook or Steve Jobs, walking into a situation like this, talking to, the shareholders of Apple,
yep.
To a much anticipated meeting, and then the whole plan getting kiboshed, on the eve of the rollout.
Yeah.
But that is exactly what's happened here.
Yeah.
I mean, for months there's been a lot of anticipation among the lay Catholic faithful and the bishops themselves, not to mention the priests, about what is going to happen in Baltimore following this summer of shame of clerical sex abuse. And so the stakes were incredibly high. And then when word came from the Vatican on Sunday night, everything, in a sense, came to a screeching halt effectively, the leadership of the conferences had to regroup this week.
Right.
I'm a reporter, so I have to try to tell both sides of the story.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, there is sort of the Vatican story, and that does remain a mystery at this point. What went wrong? Why exactly did they stop this?
Mm-hmm.
We're still figuring that out. There are a few theories floating out there. What we know is this. On October 30th is when Cardinal DiNardo and the USCCB staff sent their final documentation over to Rome, which is when they said, this is what we want to put forward when we meet in 11 days' time. And these are our expected takeaways. So what took place between October 30th and then November 11th is, unclear. One thing I will say is, having just spent a month in Rome for the Synod and spending a lot of time over there, we all know that that place operates at an incredibly slow and painful place.
Yeah.
So some observers have said, it was unrealistic that the Vatican would effectively, in one working week, have the time or the, expertise to really go through this and finally sort of check all of the requirements and the implications of this. Then again, while it may have been October 30th that they got this, for 2 months now or so, they knew what to expect.
Right.
Then there's also the February meeting. So in February, Pope Francis has called all the heads of bishops' conferences from around the world to Rome to effectively say, you know, this is my plan for tackling the clerical sex abuse crisis. And there was concern, apparently, that the U.S. bishops were getting ahead of the global church on this. So yesterday at the press conference, Cardinal DiNardo didn't say specifically whether or not Francis was aware of this. Presumably he is aware of the request to bring all this to a halt. Mm-hmm. So now everything has been postponed till February, and what we have right now is a group of, you know, 300 bishops representing 195 Catholic dioceses. Not exactly twiddling their thumbs, but they're, you know, it's simply a discussion that's being had
right
now.
Right.
And it's going to be hard to sort of walk away from this meeting with some real action items and deliverables to walk back home to their diocese with.
Yeah. The victims groups that are here, SNAP, Bishop Accountability, End Clergy Abuse, the group that I'm a part of, No More Victims, all disappointed. Some bitterly disappointed.
Yeah, tremendously so.
They see this as one more act of insensitivity at the very least. I mean, you can assume the worst, but at the very least, it's insensitive to have raised the hopes of victims and victim groups and then all of a sudden pull the rug out from under them. Does anybody think about public relations at the back? I mean, because some of this stuff is like, I can't believe it.
Well, the long overdue communications reform and a long promised communications reform of the Vatican couldn't be needed now more than ever. So we're still waiting for that to kick in, right?
Yeah. So what are you anticipating as a reporter in February?
Well, in February, I mean, I think, first off, I suspect there will be a global sort of commitment to zero tolerance. Now, that won't be new. Pope Francis has used the term. Pope Benedict has used the term, of course. But, you know, I think there will be a global commitment to zero tolerance in a way that we didn't see at the Synod. Because remember, last month at the Synod, the bishops in some of the original drafts had the phrase zero tolerance in there, and then it was sort of taken out of the document at the last minute. And the reason they gave for that is that they said that was, you know, for February. Now, in terms of other real takeaways, now, it's been, a decade now since Pope Benedict said that every bishops' conference around the world needs to have clear standards that are published on this.
Yes.
And to this day, we don't know how many bishops' conferences around the world actually have those standards in place.
Wow.
So I think February will be a reckoning for that.
Okay.
And hopefully, if the U.S. bishops get their way, you know, their policy on not just accountability for priests, but bishops, will become enshrined or codified in some sort of global church practice, or at least that's the hope. Those are the real takeaways for February. Now, yesterday I spoke with a number of the, you know, survivors groups and bishop accountability groups, and the thing they want to see happen in these next few days ahead of that February meeting is, they say, one real takeaway and tangible action step could be that the U.S. bishops commit that in every single diocese they're going to release a list of names of credibly accused priests,
yes,
dead or alive. That's one of the things that they're putting on the table as some sort of, you know, intermediate step.
But are these those who are criminally responsible, or are they going to deal with sexual misconduct in a broader way, which we all know is happening?
Yeah, I mean, that is, of course, the question on the table here. What do we mean when we talk about sexual misconduct? I mean, I'm just up from sitting in the room with them all morning, and they're just starting to sort of flesh that out a bit, what they're talking about here. One of the things is that's on the table is this third-party reporting system in which anyone can report misconduct. And misconduct can include just sexual harassment of priests or bishops. So it's not just limited to actual abuse. You know, harassment can take a variety of forms, as we know.
Oh, yeah.
So that is one of the things that this third-party reporting system would have a mechanism to at least account for.
If I know a priest who has been involved in a long-standing relationship with a male or female, the vow of, his promise of celibacy, is that in view to be reported?
Yeah, I mean, I think with this third-party reporting mechanism, I mean, that seems to be fair game. I mean, it's hard to say at this point whether or not that will eventually be codified. But at this point, the slate is fairly clean and open as to sort of what could fall in those parameters.
Yeah, were the bishops do they show evidence of being willing to spitball this and really think about it out loud?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different proposals being put on the table. You know, I think it's fair to say a number of bishops are concerned, some even frustrated that the work that has been done since 2002. Hasn't been duly acknowledged
yeah,
by some.
That's a good point.
And there's some frustration in the room over that. But particularly with the younger bishops, a lot of the questions that they're raising are this question of sort of, you know, accountability, and not just accountability, but standards of conduct. And are we going to hold ourselves to a higher standard than we hold our employees and even our priests? You know, this sort of sense of duty and obligation that they have to be the ones to lead the way in this.
Mm-hmm. Have they discussed the relationship between these attorney generals' investigation going on in the states and what the appropriate response of bishops should be?
Well, the Pennsylvania grand jury report from August has been, you know, that chronicled seven decades of abuse, has been cited frequently. Yesterday, Bishop Chris Coyne of Burlington, Vermont, said to me, you know, if we don't get this right, someone else is going to get it right for us. And he said, that's not the reason for us to put these protocols in place, just because someone else will do it for us. But it sure should be motivating us for this.
Yeah.
So I think there is this awareness that post-Pennsylvania and the 2 months since, 3 months since then, we've got a dozen to 20 states that have their own investigations underway. And there is this concern of the likelihood of a federal investigation. I mean, it was just, you know, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that the feds issued a letter that was then forwarded on to every diocese in the country saying, do not throw away or shred any of your files. You have to save these documents.
Yeah.
Raising a lot of eyebrows as to what might be in store.
What might be coming up. Yeah. Do you anticipate that the bishops will employ sociologists, historians, theologians to actually come up with a coherent narrative of how we got into this mess?
Yeah, there has been talk of will we have another John Jay report?
Yeah.
So I mean, I think all options are on the table. Okay. Be sure.
Chris, thanks much.
Anytime, Al.
Good to have you. We'll talk again.
Sounds great.
All right? Give my best to John.
I will.
Okay. I'm Al Cresta. We'll be right back.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy. Eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
Like the saints, do our loved ones who have gone before us still participate in the living tradition of prayer? The Catholic Catechism says they participate by the witness of their lives, the transmission of their writings, and their actual prayer right now. Witnesses in heaven contemplate God, praise Him, and constantly care for those they have left on earth. When saints enter into the joy of their Master, they are put in charge of many things. The Catechism asserts that the saints' intercession is their most exalted service to God's plan. Thus, We should be asking them to intercede for us and for the entire world. Sometimes personal charisms of witnesses to God's love for mankind are passed on as the spirit of Elijah was passed on to Elisha and John the Baptist in order that their followers may have a share in their spirit. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You know what Catholic radio is? It's training for the troops. It's a interaural of the ear boot camp. The folks who listen, who grow in their faith, grow in charity, grow in all the virtues, they then go out and exert an influence far beyond just themselves. Catholic radio has an exponential effect for bringing people deeper into the faith.
Dr. Ray Guarendi thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Are you fed up with the current healthcare system, paying too much for your healthcare cost? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. Visit SolidarityHealthShare.org to join like-minded Catholics in sharing medical expenses.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruz, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net.
We have a problem. Our culture is dying and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com, a nonprofit company.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me right now, Ed Condon, the Catholic News Agency. Is it exciting to be here?
I don't know that exciting is the right word, but it's certainly unexpected.
Yeah, yeah. What did you make of yesterday?
I think not just for the media that are covering this conference, but also for the participants themselves, it was a bombshell. No one knows quite what to make of it.
Right. What's happening today?
Well, so today they've tried to move a little bit on with the ordinary business of the conference. At the beginning, they heard a report from the National Advisory Council, which is a 35-member group that's supposed to reflect the whole of the church, lay people, religious people, priests, deacons. And they delivered what was a fairly stark report saying that there was really no other priority facing the bishops' conference right now other than the abuse crisis. And they were, like everyone else, surprised and very sad that they weren't going to be seeing the kind of concrete action they thought they would.
Yeah. I've mentioned this before. Listeners heard me say it, but I'll mention it with you here and get your reaction to it. It's hard to imagine a large multinational corporation facing a crisis of this sort, which for months has been in the news and which everybody knows has been being prepared for by top leadership. And then to get to the eve of the problem solving, which is going to be public, and all of a sudden have some chairman of the board step forward and just pull the plug on the whole thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Does anybody realize how this looks to Catholics and also to the onlooking world? It looks terribly incompetent.
I think many of the bishops don't just feel it's incompetent. I think they feel it was deliberately done. And one bishop described their feelings to me as rage.
Okay. Yeah. Didn't we just get done talking about synodality?
I asked Cardinal DiNardo about that yesterday during a press conference. I said, you know, we heard a lot about synodality in the last month, particularly coming out of the Synod Bishops in Rome, and that this appeared to be a sort of very high-level executive play for church that was apparently promoting regionalism and collegial action. And he said that he thought it was, he called it a puzzle. He called it a quiz. He said he couldn't make any couldn't make any real sense of it.
Yeah, so it is as odd as it appears. I think a lot of us, not knowing all the ins and outs of ecclesiastical polity and even the politics of it, wonder, is this as strange as it appears? It is as strange as it appears.
No, anyone who is feeling confused by what they've seen in the, coming out of the conference yesterday, they are absolutely as confused as the members in the hall.
Okay, all right. Will there be any discussion about the McCarrick investigation today?
Well, I think McCarrick is going to be raised over and over again as they begin to get into the specific proposals that are now discussion items rather than action items.
Right, right.
The instance of McCarrick was raised by the National Advisory Council in their report to the bishops today, saying that they needed to see a full independent investigation that covered really the basic questions that are still unanswered by the hierarchy, including, you know, who authorized out-of-court payments to McCarrick's alleged victims, how much was given to them, who, you know, where did that money come from?
Wow. Yeah.
The basic questions of who knew what and when.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I get torn between two different things. On the one hand, I want a list of wolves in sheep's clothing. I want to know them by name. On the other hand, as a former pastor, I also know that you don't want to define people by their worst actions. So I've got this dual thing going on here, but I'm going to favor, for the sake of public clarity right now, the list of wolves in sheep's clothing. Will we get a list like that?
Of bishops?
Yeah.
I think that's probably the key question. I think a lot of people, Catholics in the pews, but also priests, are looking for bishops to apply the same kind of rigor to themselves that are applied to them. I mean, what you say about not wanting to define someone by their worst possible actions is true, but then again, many of the bishops in that hall have no difficulty defining their priests by their worst actions when the moment calls for it, so they're looking for a little reciprocity here.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so there actually is that tension between the parish clergy, the priest in the parish, and the bishop.
Absolutely. I think that there are a lot of bishops who, both in 2002 and the years since, have felt that a good way of responding to an abuse crisis is to hang some of their suspect clergy out to dry.
Right.
To look at, well, who's on the bubble here, and can we make, you know, can we advance those names out as credibly accused? Can we, you know, is that a way of showing tough action and commitment? And I think a lot of people are saying, well, are the bishops going to apply the same methodology to themselves now?
Right. Yeah, very good. Do the bishops, I guess that's a question. Do they have any history of fraternal correction in any public sense?
I'm not aware of any in this country that rises to the level that people are looking to see, particularly in the fallout of the McCarrick scandal. And I think that's one of the things that really needs to be looked at. The standards of conduct that had been proposed for an action item and are now going to be a discussion item, I guess, for this conference, really, it had a number of criticisms leveled against it before we even arrived and found out that it wasn't going to be bindingly voted on.
Yeah.
And one of those was that it didn't go far enough, in that it basically was bishops being asked to make a promise to not do things they already had promised not to do.
Yeah, they're read the New Testament. I mean, the one another commands of the New Testament, love one another, serve one another, admonish one another. You need a professional code of ethics? So that, what, we can fire you if you sleep with your client or something? I mean,
well, and so the reverse of the coin was that many priests and deacons and lay people working in the church, particularly in diocesan chanceries, are asked to sign similar, you know, codes of conduct. And so this is
already.
Yeah, so this is part of bringing a similar level of accountability
to the
bishops.
Gotcha.
Which is in itself a good thing. But, you know, there are questions of, you know, if they need to be told, what does that say about the state we're in?
What are they doing there if they need to be told? I agree. And I'm not sure what to make of that. I was talking to a therapist about this because she was saying it's a good thing that they have a professional code of ethics because therapists are subjected to this kind of thing. I thought, okay, that's fine. But wait a minute. The whole point of becoming a bishop is different than becoming a therapist, a licensed clinician by a state agency. The fullness of the priesthood resides in the episcopacy. So there's expected that this is not just somebody who's applying for a senior level administrative post. This is somebody who's been tried and tested by pastoral experience, which raises another question. Do you have any idea how many bishops have themselves been pastors?
Not off the top of my head.
With assemblies and congregations.
Not off the top of my head, although I can think of many bishops who have a very good pastoral sense to them already. And, I mean, I think one of the things that we will be very interesting to see as this conference develops is how many bishops lose patience with the sort of collegial emphasis that's always been placed on it. I mean, bishops are bred to avoid public conflict. They want to present a united face, to appear that they know they're acting in concert, that there's full agreement. And in sort of peacetime conditions, that's great. But now I think a lot of them are saying, well, are we just at this point providing safety in numbers for the minority that have cost us all our credibility?
Right.
And I wonder if we won't begin to see some of the bishops say, well, hang on, I'm tired of having to go home to my diocese and carry the can for people who did things that I would never do.
Absolutely. That's what I want to see them do. I want to see them show that they're as outraged by this behavior as laity is. I understand the importance of showing solidarity, but right now, the American bishops have all the moral authority of Bill Cosby, and what you have is a suspicion over all of them, and it's not right. It's not. I'm assuming it's not right, because personally, bishops I know, generally I like them. I assume they're in their own way, they're kind of victimized by some sort of system here. Do you think that there will be a break like that so that, again, I come back to the wolves in sheep clothing thing?
It's difficult to tell. I think it really is going to come down to if someone loses patience and whether or not that, that's the crack in the dam that leads to a flood. What I would say is bishops like to talk about fraternal correction. They like to talk about being a brotherhood, being a family.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a good thing. But I think one of the things that they could usefully discover in the course of this conference is that families fight.
Yes, absolutely. Brothers fight.
Brothers fight. They roll on
the floor. They have bruises.
And they call each other out when it needs to be done. And I think that's maybe an aspect of fraternal life that needs to be rediscovered very quickly.
Yeah. Okay. There was a discussion yesterday. You mentioned the National Review conversation that happened today. Was that well received?
I'm sorry, which conference?
Was it a National Review Board or something that gave a statement earlier today? Was that well received?
It was very well received. They received a standing ovation, which is great. It's good to see that the bishops were responding to a committee that comprises all aspects of the church, different races, different age groups, different states of life from across the country, delivering what was a very hard message. And the bishops, to a man, stood up and applauded, and that's great. But one of the things they told the bishops was, we need to see something that moves beyond promises of future reform. We need to see concrete action. We need to see real steps taken. And unfortunately, this conference has already been told, basically, you can't do that.
Right. Many people throw out all kinds of words to describe how we got to where we are right now. Homosexual clergy... that made some decision somewhere that they were going to indulge their lusts. Clericalism, the idea that there's a club that these guys have. Careerism, people who think that somehow they want to climb this ladder, which is the Catholic Church. It's not that big a ladder, but they think they can do it. Are they using language like that down there? Homosexual clergy, careerism, clericalism?
Well, clericalism has certainly been mentioned several times. I think the issue of homosexual clergy, actively homosexual clergy, that is, began to come out a little bit in the last session where they have started to discuss some of these now discussion points, no longer action points, the first of which involved the setting up of an independent third-party reporting mechanism for accusations against bishops of sexual misconduct. And a lot of the bishops were insisting, and they mentioned this earlier in the day, actually, when they were receiving the National Review Board's recommendations, that there needs to be a clear line between episcopal misconduct that involves the abuse of minors and episcopal misconduct involving adults. And that is a useful line to draw, I think.
Yes.
But what needs to come with it is, if we're going to say those are two completely separate issues, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say, there needs to be a full discussion of what are the causes of uncelibate clergy and
right.
sexual misconduct involving adults, with the same depth and examination that has gone into investigating the abuse of minors.
Yeah, okay. We've got only about 30 seconds here. Was there so there was some conversation about non-criminal sexual misconduct.
The issue began to be broached. How in-depth they're willing to go, we'll see.
Okay. Ed, thank you so much for your work and for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ed Condon, Catholic News Agency. I'm Al Cresta.
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference, November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical, and in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at charitymobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruise, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's two coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net. It's time to take control of your healthcare journey and experience healthcare fully alive with CMF Curo. Krista and Justin say,
we love having the understanding, decision-making, and control of our healthcare in our own hands and having the option to bear one another's burdens. But most importantly, we love helping others when they need medical support.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry that values the health of the whole person, spirit, mind, and body.
To experience healthcare fully alive for you and your family, visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
A federal district court in Washington, D.C. recently denied a motion filed by the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, in a failed effort to eliminate the consumer fraud allegations advanced against the organization in a civil case set to go to trial early next year. The lawsuit alleges that Morris Days, the resident attorney and manager for civil rights at a now-defunct CARE chapter in Virginia, was in fact not an attorney and that he failed to provide legal services for clients who came to CARE for legal representation. As alleged, CARE knew of this fraud and purposely conspired with Days to cover it up. The American Freedom Law Center represents the 5 Muslim plaintiffs in this case who were victims of this massive fraud. CARE, a self-described Muslim public interest law firm, was previously named as a Muslim Brotherhood Hamas front group by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office. The result of the trial court's ruling in our case is that CARE National must now stand trial for violations of Virginia's statutory consumer fraud. The decade-long litigation exposes CARE to more than $1 million in legal fees alone. Given CARE's pedigree and mission, it is no wonder that the organization was prepared to deal corruptly with its own Muslim clients in an attempt to cover up a massive fraud made possible by its own attorney and staff. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We're continuing in Baltimore, Maryland, at the annual Fall Assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And the first reading for the Monday, yesterday, which is the day the annual fall meeting began, is the first reading from the first chapter of St. Paul's letter to Titus, and in which he describes the qualifications of a bishop. My guest, Monsignor Charles Pope, has done an exposition of this passage, which was published on his blog at adw.org, the Archdiocese of Washington. Monsignor Pope is pastor of Holy Martyrs St. Cyprian Parish. And Monsignor, it's good to have you back here. Thanks.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Let's talk about this. I think oftentimes laity don't look carefully at the biblical material when it deals with the qualifications for bishop or elders and deacons, depending on other passages in 1 Timothy chapter 3. But let's talk about this Titus passage. What are the qualities of a bishop that St. Paul is addressing here?
Well, it's interesting. He's writing to Titus, whom he's appointed to be the bishop in Crete. And he basically says, I left you in Crete so that you might set right what remains to be done. So in other words, he's the first, you know, if you will, role is that a bishop, by overseeing, should, you know, bring a church, in this case or a regional church, into order. We kind of get the word holy orders from there. Mm-hmm. And and one of the ways that he should do that is to appoint presbyters, that is to say priests in every town. And he should, you know, oversee those priests and make sure that these presbyters are good, God-fearing, blameless men of good character and so on. And so again, we would probably just begin there, that the very first thing that a bishop is to do is to bring a church and to bring it into order, so to speak, and to make sure that it's doing what the Lord would have it do.
So this idea of we want a stable environment, right, for people to grow.
Yes.
Stable and secure environment, and mm-hmm. by setting it right. Okay, good. That's foundational.
And I would say, you know, Al, that I think this has been, you know, a real struggle in our time, that at times, you know, many people don't feel safe in Catholic settings, not just
right.
about the sexual abuse, but even just, what crazy thing am I going to hear from the priest, or, you know, what crazy, you know. So this is, again, I think, a challenge for our times. And again, I'm going to say I'm a priest. I do not run a perfect parish. So this is at every level in the church. But as I say, so, yeah, certainly this is a challenge. But it's an essential work of a bishop to oversee a church.
You also point out that regarding this, the bishop is supposed to make secure the sound message. In other words, there shouldn't be any real question about sound doctrine.
Right.
And you also, I mean, in what you were saying earlier, that's also a concern for a lot of people. They wonder if, in fact, they're getting sound doctrine from their priests. What's the history on this? How did it get to that point? Has it always been that way? Or is this a phenomenon of the last, you know, generation?
Yeah. Well, I think we've had ups and downs with this in church history, but I do say there's a line here at the end of the reading from yesterday that says that the bishop must be able to exhort with sound doctrine and refute opponents, silent opponents.
Yeah.
Indeed, there are many many people you know that are you know rebellious and don't want to listen to the truth. So I think that one of the things that a lot of Catholics have struggled a great deal with over is the open dissent that seems to be easily tolerated by too many, not all, but too many bishops. Things that go on in our universities that are taught that are in complete opposition to our faith, the moral life of the students. And then we see that even in our Catholic schools, but in our parishes, and there's a lot of liturgical abuses and things that people have had to tolerate for decades. And I think there is something unique about the current times. For some reason, we, at least in America, we're allergic to authority, and not just that we don't like being under authority, but even those of us who have authority seem very reluctant to use it to bring things into order. And again, as I say, do I have a perfect record? I do not. So I'd say these things to myself, but it's a very unusual phenomenon we're in. After about 1968, you know, the whole revolution was not just about sex or feminism or what have you. It was also about a rebellion against authority.
Yeah.
So I think that there's something in our climate that has contributed to this as well.
I've noticed over the years that it's not uncommon to hear a priest or even a bishop give a kind of side warning. I said, you know, be careful, that person's a little rigid. I almost never hear somebody say, be careful, that person's a little loose. There's a fear of rigidity in a way that there's not an equivalent fear of looseness or laxity when it comes to doctrine, liturgy, morality. I think that's kind of telling. It shows a certain cultural bias that we're swimming in against authority.
Yeah, I do think that. And I would also say that I think another thing that probably contributes to it is a culture in the church, and maybe not just the church, but that the men who tend to get promoted to the office of bishop tend to be, well, fairly mild-mannered, kind of right. Company men. They don't take a lot of risk or say, really prophetic things. Now, again, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, they don't rock the boat, you know, and they kind of keep things kind of on an even keel that way. But on the other hand, because of that, they're not really prone to, as Paul says here, that the bishop should refute opponents to the faith, refute them. And again, not just by, you know, punishing them, but by saying, what Father so-and-so has said here is simply not in accord with our teachings, and I'm sorry that you had to hear that from him, or so-and-so. Now, like, we have this, I won't mention his name, but, you know, we all know there's a priest that runs all over the world promoting the LGBTQIA with no reference to repentance.
Right.
And only one bishop I know of in the world, and again, I say in a published sense, you know, Cardinal Sarah has refuted him. And now, again, I'm not saying other bishops haven't, and maybe in settings that I'm not aware of, but I have to say, this is the kind of stuff that, again, I really, really hope that our bishops would hear from us. This crisis we're in now is much older than just since June or since 2003, and it's not just about the sexual misconduct of priests. It's about so many other issues in the church today that our good holy people have just had to endure for decades.
Yeah. Is the reluctance to refute opponents, to rebuke rebuke those who are championing false doctrine, is the reluctance to do that, is that a lack of courage? Or do people just think it's in bad form?
Yeah. I got to figure it's both. You know, we have to, maybe not even just courage, but even fortitude. Because, you know, fortitude is more than about just courage. It's about sometimes having to stay in long conversations, and it gets weary refuting and correcting, and it's wearisome. And so fortitude is that virtue that sort of helps us to stick to it, even though the journey is hard. It gets a little wearying at times.
Yes.
So fortitude as well as courage, I think also, you're right. There's just sort of this attitude today, oh, well, no, we don't want any controversy, and so we keep suing for peace. Well, how's that working for us? You know, we look darker and darker, and we avoid the conflict today, but we just postpone it. We kick the can down the road, and it just gets worse.
Yeah.
And so, as I say, somewhere along the line, it's that daily cross the Lord talks about, you know, taking up our cross daily. Because if you don't take up a daily cross, you're going to have a monthly cross or a yearly cross. And so those are much heavier. And so, as I say, just little, you know, sometimes a priest might make a rookie mistake, and a good bishop will just say, Father, let's avoid that in the future. But again, all of this is just just overlooked, and it isn't corrected in little ways, and things get worse. So I can't tell everyone how to run, you know, their diocese, obviously. But I think at some point we need more of that idea of holy order that bishops need to work with.
You know, I wonder if part of it is that underneath many people, including priests and bishops, just don't have a lot of confidence in propositional truth, that you can speak the truth in words, and those words are worth, you know, that proper formula is worth fighting for. They say, well, you know, reality is much more than just the formulation of it. Well, yes, it is, but the propositions are important. It's like the roadmap. The roadmap isn't the destination, but you don't want people screwing around with the roadmap.
Yeah, I think that it is. You know, the question of theologian bishops and so on, you know, how well studied. But I also think, and some have pondered, that today we do seem to be suffering, not just bishops, of course, and priests, but all of us, with a kind of a lack of faith. We're not that confident that it's possible to live a lot of the truths of the faith. And we hand out annulments so quickly. We're you know, all the talk about marriage, divorce, and communion, and it's almost like you don't dare challenge God's people. And where's our hope? Where's our confidence in grace that if the Lord commands something or teaches this to us, that we can live it if we lay hold of it? And it may take time, but we'll get there. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of, strong hope and a sense of the power of grace to help people to live these ways. And so we kind of settle down with a tepid mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
And we just accept, well, this is kind of hard for people, you know, it's tough. And so, as I say, I think we have to be smart and be prudent, but at the end of the day, we don't. Where's the vigorous hope? Where's the calling people to even a kind of a martyrdom that the early church certainly had to do? I mean, to join the church in the early days was to almost seal your death sentence or to lose your business contact. You were going to suffer.
Yeah.
And they were used to that. But the idea of martyrdom today is almost never preached. Any idea of even thinking for a minute about suffering for the faith is a very poorly done topic. It isn't something we speak much about.
Isn't part of that that we've kind of lost the horizon of eternal life? It seems spectral, distant, insubstantial. Maybe that's part of it. We're not as confident that we can, that eternal life is something we ought to be sacrificing for.
Yeah, you know, there's also that what we call the bland universalism. Everybody's going to go to heaven anyway. Even though that's completely contrary to what Scripture says, you know, the idea that we're in a battle for souls, starting with our own, and we priests and bishops got to get in there and get in the battle and start snatching people out of the storm and getting them onto the ark. And they're out there drowning in a moral confusion. Meanwhile, our Holy Father seems to have weaponized ambiguity. And we're not being as clear. And so there's this idea that, oh my gosh, I'm in a battle for souls and I need to speak the truth to people in love so they can lay hold of this and not be swallowed up in a world of confusion and infidelity.
Yeah, in speaking with your brother priests, would the majority of them understand what you're talking about right now?
You know, I think there's a big difference in the kind of the age. You know,
yes.
I'm 57, so I'm kind of, I would say the priests who are younger than I am, they're really on top of this. They have a real sense of these are critical times. Whereas the older priests, oh, come on, settle down. And,
okay.
And so there's a kind of, I think, a generational thing. Again, there are exceptions on both sides of the number, but the idea is that I think the younger priests have this sense that we're in a real battle because they've had to live through, you know, a kind of horrifying culture where some of us remember a time when things were a little more settled, before the revolution. But as I say, at the end of the day, the younger priests, I think, are much more prone to get the idea of this battle.
Yeah. Monsignor, thank you again for all that you do and for joining us today. And we'll make sure people are pointed to blog.aedw.org. Thank you, Monsignor.
Thank you, Al.
Monsignor Charles Pope will have his column on the office of a bishop over at AlvinMirrorRadio.net. Check the Crest of Guest Archives. And again, Monsignor Pope is somebody you should read daily or whenever he publishes.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical. And in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at charitymobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture, whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is, go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
How do I handle difficult family members? When do I correct others? When do I hold my tongue? Too often, we're late in realizing that we mishandle a situation, causing both resentment and frustration. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. And in my new book, Thinking Like Jesus, I tackle these questions and more. Check it out and more of my books at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Well, thank you much. Good being with you this hour. Let me remind you, we've got another hour coming up on Crest in the Afternoon. I hope you're not going to miss it, because in this next hour, we're going to take time with Matthew Bunsen to get the most immediate update possible on what's going on the floor of the annual Fall Assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They may not be taking action on the sex abuse crisis, but they are discussing it. So we'll be sharing that information with you in the next hour. Also, Father John Trigilio, from his wide experience, he and I are going to have a freewheeling conversation about priests and bishops and laity and how do we get to this situation. What are the problems that he sees? And he speaks from a unique vantage point. He's not only been a longtime priest of the Diocese of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, but he's also director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, our oldest seminary in the United States, and an especially good one. And he's also heads up the Congregation for Catholic Clergy, so he understands very much how clergy are experiencing this suspicion that now rests over them. And I do think that one of the major problems that the bishops are going to have to face is, how do you bleach out this suspicion? Because it is damaging the work of the new evangelization. It's very difficult to be presenting the Lord Jesus Christ in the context of his church, when in fact most people's impression of the Catholic Church at this time is that it's damaged goods. How do you change that perception? Well, you can't just change an image. You've got to change a reality. And that's what's making this difficult. So stay with me. We got another hour coming up here on Cresta in the Afternoon in Baltimore.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The Church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We're into another hour here on Cresta in the Afternoon. If you didn't catch the first hour, go back and get it, all right? We had a great conversation going on with both Ed Condon from Catholic News Agency and Chris White from Crux and The Tablet. And then also a wonderful conversation with Monsignor Charles Pope about the pastoral epistle's description of the good bishop from Titus chapter 1. You can also check 1 Timothy chapter 3. But coming up in this hour now, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, who's been on the floor of the convention here in Baltimore. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops are recovering from the slapdown yesterday, which I'm going to continue to call it that. the Holy See deciding that they would insist that the U.S. bishops not come up with actionable items for vote regarding the sex abuse crisis. However, the bishops today have said we're moving forward, not with action items necessarily, but discussion items. And there's also been an expansion of their agenda, which Matthew will share with us in just a little while. And then we're going to spend time with Father John Trigilio, a priest who has lived through this era, who's also heads up the Congregation for the Catholic Clergy, who's a director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, one of our foremost seminaries in the United States. And he has also been speaking on EWTN for over 20 years with Web of Faith. And he's a priest of the Diocese of Harrisburg. So this is a guy who's lived it. I want to talk with him, kind of a freewheeling conversation of what it's like to be a priest through these decades. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, November 13th. It's the Feast of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano sent a message today to the fall meeting of the USCCB, encouraging them to act as courageous shepherds in the face of the sex abuse crisis. In part, he instructs the bishops to meditate on Proverbs 9:10, which states, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." It was intended that the assembly would vote on proposals meant to form the basis for a response to the sexual abuse crisis facing the church in the U.S., but Cardinal Daniel DiNardo announcing Monday morning that the Congregation for Bishops has directed that that vote be not held. Israel and Hamas are reportedly agreeing to a ceasefire after a wave of deadly violence. The ceasefire was brokered by Egypt, but tensions remain high. Hamas and other militant groups launched hundreds of rockets into Israel this week, and Israel responded with scores of airstrikes in Gaza. The death count is still being assessed. California's deadliest and most destructive wildfire in history is continuing to grow. CAL FIRE Captain Joe Almendore says there are several reasons why they couldn't put in more containment lines on the Camp Fire.
In some parts, it's very dense terrain, very hard to get in there. Other parts of the fire, it could be simply because we just haven't got there yet.
The official death toll remains at 42, but about 200 people are still missing. And opening statements in the trial of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman are being delayed. A judge reportedly excused one juror shortly before proceedings began this morning. There's an unprecedented security in place in Brooklyn for the trial of one of the most notorious drug kingpins in history. The jury has armed escorts, and all its members are being kept anonymous. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, continuing in Baltimore, Maryland, at the annual Fall Assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Small protests out today. With me right now, though, is Dr. Matthew Bunsen. He's been reporting on the floor of the Assembly. Good to see you again.
Good to be here, as always.
Tell me, what's the headline?
I think the headline is that the bishops, despite what happened yesterday, and the Holy See informing them that they are not to conduct votes on what they think are the necessary steps to deal with the clergy sexual abuse crisis, especially as it relates to bishop accountability, are pushing ahead, nevertheless, with their discussions on those very points. I think what we're seeing is not a rebellion against what the Holy See wants to do or has asked them to do. It's that they see this as so important an issue that they want to inform themselves as a body about these documents. And then to hand off to Cardinal DiNardo when he goes to Rome, he's president of the USCCB, or the Conference of Catholic Bishops, and takes part in this February meeting,
right,
with the Holy Father, that they want him to have all the tools at his disposal to be fully informed about what the options are here in the United States so that he can then inform his brother bishops. I think it's a very sound strategy.
So they're basically going ahead. The only thing that will be different is that these are discussion items rather than action items.
Correct.
Is the discussion hefty?
It has been.
So it's not weaker as a result of it not being...
No, I think there's been today at the start of the discussions, at the start of the agenda, they had to approve the agenda. And there was a signal right at the very beginning that right at the start, the request was made to add to the agenda of these items to be discussed a letter or an appeal to the Holy See, to Pope Francis, to release all of the documents related to Cardinal McCarrick and his case. That was, I see this as a watershed moment in this fall assembly, because it recaptured, I think, the sense of why they were here. And it gave encouragement and a certain momentum to those who felt and do feel that this is a conversation that has to happen. And McCarrick continues to be at the heart of this crisis today.
Okay. So this was there was a motion. Was there a vote?
There was. It was a voice vote, as they always are. It was a robust yes.
Wow.
A small smattering of noes. So it was added to the agenda.
90-10, 80-20, 70-30.
I would say probably 90-10.
Yeah.
Maybe
so
a little higher.
Overwhelmingly positive.
Yes, absolutely.
Nobody can dispute that.
So what's happened is that this has been attached to the agenda as an item for discussion. Now,
that's a bit of a chess move, huh?
Exactly. That, yes. And that's my other takeaway for the day, that we're seeing a kind of chess game being played here.
Yeah.
In moving, not just looking at the victims as pawns, quite the opposite. I think the bishops here see that this crisis is of such a dimension, of such severity, that they need to move very carefully. And they have to have a very sound strategy going forward and how they're going to deal with it as a body, but also as individual bishops. And they receive strong support from the different organizations that the USCCB has to support this. For example, the National Advisory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
That committee, which advises the bishops, was strong in its endorsement of an investigation into all of the things related to Theodore McCarrick.
And they delivered a report this morning.
They did.
Yeah.
And then we also had a very similar affirmation of the same type of investigation by the National Review Board. At the end of the National Advisory Committee, there was a standing ovation from
nice.
The bishops.
Wow.
And it was interesting to watch because it started as a trickle. Several bishops stood up and
Who stood up first? Could you tell me?
Yeah, I think we'll let that one go.
Okay.
But it was a smattering across the room, and then one by one, the bishops rose, and it went on for quite some time. So the bishops were heartened by what they heard, but also, I think, given encouragement, which is one of the things that coming out of yesterday, you could see that there was a certain level of demoralization that had set in.
I can imagine, yeah. I mean, it wasn't my project, but I was demoralized. You know?
All of us in the room, the air went out
yeah.
of the room as we were talking yesterday. I think there was a certain sense of elan, to use the French term, that was recaptured today. And it was quite striking to see.
That's good. The fact that they added on to the agenda is itself rather bold. Don't you think?
I would agree. I think it was a very bold gesture, and we began hearing from a number of bishops, Bishop Thomas Paprocki, for example.
Yeah. Springfield?
Springfield, yes.
Yeah,
hockey player. that's important to note, I know.
I'm glad to hear that.
In fact, he mentioned it to me just this morning, that he stood up and he said, look, we're not trying to be disobedient to the Holy See here, but we also aren't branch managers.
Nice.
We are shepherds. And I think that also was a tone setter for the rest of the day. I want to add, too, that in my piece for the Register that I wrote yesterday, I make a very, what to me is a very important addition that was lost in the discussion when the announcement was made yesterday about the Holy See asking not to vote. And that was the point of day one was for them to be in prayer and penance.
Yes.
And that I had the idea. At least I think what they were trying to do with this is to impart to the bishops the severity of this spiritually, that the dimensions of, the spiritual crisis that is also at the heart of this. And yesterday may have had a very salutary effect as the day went on of listening to the victims, of praying, of adoration, and then the Mass, of the penitential readings, of the call for reform and renewal. And I'm optimistic, I'm hopeful, that part of that prayer-filled time also is being seen today and having had its effect.
I know the first reading yesterday was from Titus chapter 1, which has to do with the qualifications for a bishop.
Yeah.
So that was nice.
And it's funny how the challenges haven't changed, have they?
No. I mean, that's why we were saying, to talk about a professional code of ethics, it's like a little bit redundant. I mean, go to Titus 1 or 1 Timothy 3.
Yeah, the pastoral epistles are valuable for any bishop, I think, yeah.
Well, that sounds good. So you sense that there was a little more, there was a recovery of their own sense of mission.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that they were, that they have courage now. What I do mean is I think there was a certain discouragement because of the sheer shock of what happened yesterday with the announcement.
Yeah.
But also the sense of, okay, how do we respond to this? How are we faithful to our people, to our congregations, or our flock, while at the same time recognizing and accepting what the Holy See has asked us to do? And I always say that if you put 300 bishops in a room, at the end of the day, you're going to end up with the mind of the church.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing today.
Yeah, yeah. Good. You mentioned Bishop Paparocki of Springfield, Illinois. Anybody else stand out in your mind in terms of motivating?
I think we've Bishop Pfeiffer. I'm trying to remember where he's from exactly, but my apologies. But he spoke about the spiritual dimensions of it. Bishop Murray, who of course has just recently recovered from very severe illness, gave a very timely intervention in saying that let's remember what this is about. This is the victims,
yeah.
Which can be lost in this whole process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And in the afternoon session, we heard a great deal of discussion about how they would potentially move forward with this kind of review board, which, of course, the Holy See essentially said, no, you can't vote on that.
Right.
I begin to appreciate a little bit why there might be concern in Rome about it, because it is a hazy structure.
Yes, a lay review board.
A lay review board. Yeah. It is a third-party type of a structure. Cardinal Supich, in fairness, made the observation, are we at risk of outsourcing some of this?
Well, how would that be outsourcing? I mean, the laity are the body of Christ, for heaven's sakes. They're not outsiders. I mean, what is this, a professional club that laity are supposed to somehow get down and ask him to just let us in so we can watch? I mean, this is the body of Christ.
How that's going to work, though, how much that
will
cost.
I agree that has to be worked out.
And there are theological...
What I'm saying is that there's, in my estimate, there's no necessary... there's no necessary exclusion of laity from this process.
Right.
Baptism, this is a responsibility of all the baptized to exhort one another, encourage one another, and to accompany those who are hurting.
And we go back to one of the fundamental problems that we talked about during the summer in the wake of the McCarrick scandal, that the notion that the bishops can police themselves... is simply not a viable option.
Not under these circumstances.
We have to have the Holy Father involved, but we also have to have the laity involved if the credibility is going to be there. One other point that I'll be watching very carefully over the discussions for the rest of the day and certainly through tomorrow is the distinction that is increasingly being made by a number of bishops, and this is this we'll have to see how it plays out, between sexual impropriety.
Yes.
In other words, say homosexuality among the priesthood, in other words, consensual sex versus what were the cases of abuse and other things. Because that is a distinction that I'm seeing a number of bishops trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And how that plays out, we'll have to see.
Well, there clearly is a distinction here between criminal behavior. But I, in some ways, you can look at sexual harassment maybe is somewhat criminal, but I would say that you're dealing with sexual impropriety and misconduct in the terms of you've got consensual relations between clergy. To me, that's you're not going to be arrested for it, but you ought to be some way have your faculties revoked or lay us. I'm not sure what the proper function punishment should be, but that is unacceptable.
It's unacceptable, but there is also the risk of blurring what can be the abuse of power.
Yes.
Which we saw in the McCarrick case, the alleged improprieties of former Cardinal McCarrick involving seminarians, which would technically, in the eyes of a lot of defenders, be consensual, and yet could very well be an abuse of power and potentially even criminal.
Yes, I'm all for making the distinctions along the way, as long as under one umbrella we say all is unacceptable.
Yes.
We can't tolerate any of this.
And that's where we heard a number of bishops just today talking about the holiness, universal call to holiness, the holiness that we have to expect of our bishops.
Yeah.
And it was refreshing, but it was also an essential aspect of any conversation.
Yeah.
If we're going to have the right kinds of bishops.
Yeah, I'm sure it's got to be incredibly frustrating for many bishops to have to be talking about what to them is foundational. It is our life project. If you're among the baptized into Christ Jesus, your life project is conformity to Christ.
Yes.
It is seeing his life reproduced in yours. It is what we call the universal call to holiness. And to have to be reminding bishops, I don't know how many, but reminding some anyways.
A depressing number.
Yes, that this is what we are about. I'm glad to hear it, though. That it was vigorous.
It was.
Matthew, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen, I'm Al Krestel. We'll be right back.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Did you know there are two kinds of tantrums? The first type, distress tantrums, are the most common in children 4 and under. They aren't the result of children trying to manipulate you as much as your kids being overwhelmed, overstimulated, or frustrated. The best cure for distress tantrums is bringing your child to a quiet place and providing lots of loving attention to help your child calm down and come back online. The second type, manipulative tantrums, occur in children who are old enough to have good self-control but still use drama as a tool. The best way to respond to these tantrums is to calmly place the child in a quiet, safe, timeout place until he's calm enough to apologize sincerely, accept your direction, and rehearse the more appropriate alternative with you. How long are they in for? Well, that's up to them. Want more tips to make discipline easier? Check out my book, Parenting with Grace. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Ben.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
Let us strive to know the Lord. Quick question to you and me right now. Is that what you and I are doing every single day? When you and I wake up every day, do we strive to know Jesus or not? In the Old Testament, in the same book of Hosea, a little bit later on, it's in chapter 14, the Lord says through the prophet, "My people perish," or in another translation, "My people are being destroyed because of a lack of knowledge." Not a lack of data. We got tons of data. Not a lack of information. We got a lot of information. Not just about things that are happening in the world. We got a lot of data, a lot of knowledge, a lot of information about God. But not a lot of intimacy with God. Not a lot of relationship with God. Not a lot of friendship. That's the cry of God's heart. God wants to give himself to us in the incredible gift of friendship, and we're not taking advantage of it.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We continue here in Baltimore, Maryland at the annual Fall Assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Joining me right now is a man that you know well, Father John Trigilio. He has hosted EWTN's longest-running program, Web of Faith. He is president of the Confraternity of Catholic Clergy. He is also director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and a priest of the Diocese of Harrisburg. Right?
Yes, Al, that covers everything.
Well, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, yeah. Al. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on here in Baltimore with the bishops. Yesterday, there was this announcement that the Holy See had told the U.S. bishops not to come up with any policy regarding sexual abuse and or any further discussion, any further policy making about questions of sexual abuse, to postpone this until after the February or during the February meeting. In your experience, is it common for the Holy See to intervene at the last minute on something like this? This came across from somebody like myself who's an observer. This came across like a slapdown.
Yeah, I've heard people refer to the nuclear option, which gives you a little, like they use in Washington, D.C. It's very unusual that the Holy See would intervene at such a late date, particularly since Cardinal DiNardo and a few of the bishops have been in communication, correspondence, and even personally visited over there.
Even the language of the policy was out there for weeks.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So had this been something like out of the blue that the bishops were going to do something, then that would have made sense for the, like, for instance, if hypothetically if the bishops wanted to make Christmas no longer a holy day of obligation, I could see the Vatican saying, no, we're not going to do that. But they know, for instance, that they haven't agreed on the same age for confirmation, so that's something that the bishops need to work on, and they knew that they were going to talk about this issue, so the fact that that happened the way it did, one thing I'm also intrigued by, that there are American bishops and cardinals and priests who work in Rome, and you know that saying, you know, how's it play in Peoria?
Yeah,
one of them I think should have said to somebody, this is how it's going to play in Peoria. It's not going to look good.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes in Rome, they think in different terms. I mean, obviously, you know, Rome's been around for the diocese of Rome has been for 2,000 years.
Sure.
Rome itself has been there longer than that. Here in the United States, we're used to things being so quick and instant, and we're in a short time span. But that being said, there are Americans over there who you would think would have said something either to the Holy Father or to one of his personal advisors and say, this isn't going to look too good the way it's coming off right now, but I don't know if maybe they did say something and it wasn't listened to. I don't know.
Yeah. It's difficult when there are expectations that the bishops are going to act in a way that they hope will regain moral authority and respect among the American Catholics and the onlooking world, then to be stalled. And obviously they're going to comply with the Holy See's instruction here. How come nobody fights about it?
About the fact that Vatican intervened? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we know that this was disturbing. But I haven't heard a bishop stand up and make an argument to say that they thought this was an imprudent move on the part of the Holy See. And should they? The etiquette here is not as familiar to laity as it is to clergy, and that's the reason I bring it up.
Yes, and I think that's good for people to look at. I don't want to say that it's an exact analogy, but when you look at the relationship, say, in the military, if you're a soldier or a sailor, you're really not in a position to publicly criticize the admirals
sure.
or the your higher ranking officers, even though they may make imprudent decisions. Obviously, you are obligated to disobey an immoral
yes.
or unlawful order in
right.
the military. And the same in the church. You're obligated to disobey any order that would be considered sinful. But that being said, the prudential judgments that popes and cardinals and bishops and even pastors,
sure.
That's something that you legitimately can disagree with. I've had parishioners disagree with some things that I said and
yeah.
did, and we priests, you know, do so with our bishops. So I think that it has to be done respectfully, but remember, the church is still a hierarchy, and we don't want to confuse people to think that because we believe in the charism of infallibility, that this extends to everything, because obviously it's very restricted to faith and morals.
Right.
And it has to be that the Pope is teaching as a universal teacher. But he does have universal authority, even though it may not be an infallible decision. He is the supreme judge and the supreme lawgiver and the supreme governor, as we say, the threefold munera Christi, you know, the priest, prophet, and king.
Right.
So there is no higher authority than the Pope. So you can't appeal to a council. You can't appeal to a synod, even if you respectfully disagree. But that means you have the opportunity, though, to have hopefully dialogue and say, well, here's where we hope we could change your mind, or maybe you could reconsider. You're allowed to do that. I was able to do that with the bishop. Parishioners could come to me and say, Father, could you reconsider your decision? But I think what Rome wants to avoid is the idea of trusteeism, where in the United States we had that phenomenon where the people took over the churches, and yeah, it was prompted because there were abuses in that, but we fought that
right.
because of the integrity of doctrine and the validity of the sacraments.
Right. But is that the kind of lay concern that we're seeing now, and the phrase that I'm using is one that I picked up from Benedict, and that is the co-responsibility of the lay faithful.
Yes.
You know, and the Canadian bishops have a whole document on this too. But that is, there's nothing in my thinking on this that equates to the trusteeship controversy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because nobody's talking about holding properties. You know
no,
what I'm saying?
No, I agree with you there, but I think I'm trying to understand where I think Rome's coming from, and I
yeah.
obviously don't speak for the Holy Father
yeah,
or
sure.
for
no.
Holy See, but what I think what concern they may have is that the proposal to have a lay board that would have the authority to overlook bishops, that looks good from an American standpoint,
right.
because that's sort of our jurisprudence, but from a hierarchical standpoint, I would say it would probably make more sense if the bishops may have maybe proposed that you have a tribunal that's composed of clergy and laity,
sure.
so that way you get a balance, and of course that's always subject to the highest authority, which is the Holy Father.
Who's the only one that really can discipline bishops, is that right?
Well, the Congregation of Bishops can have some influence. Like if a bishop misbehaves...
I guess I always assume that the Curia is an extension of,
yes.
of the Pope. Yeah.
But, you know, they have the chain of command, so that what happens is, let's say, hypothetically, if a bishop in a diocese misbehaves, then the metropolitan, the archbishop of that region,
mm-hmm.
would report that then to the Congregation of Bishops,
okay.
and then they in turn would report that to the Holy Father. And then if there was a decision to discipline or even remove, that would come from the Holy Father,
right.
but he would issue it through the congregation, then to the nuncio. But I think people sometimes get the impression that the bishops cover for each other, and I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I think we do need some oversight, overview, and I think the people are rightfully, you know, upset about neglect that has taken place over
right.
the years.
Right. I think the ecclesial culture, the way bishops relate to one another, there's no apparent fraternal correction. And I understand jurisdictional questions. That doesn't bother me so much. But you don't need to have jurisdictional authority to go to a brother bishop and say, I think you're acting like a, I think you're acting indecently here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you don't have any power, you know what I'm saying, over him, but you have moral authority as a brother. And I don't see,
You're right. I think that's where, that's something that needs to be addressed. Because even in the diocese, we're told as priests, you know, you need to practice some fraternal correction. Now, priests can say, mind your own business, you know, who made you Mother Teresa?
Right.
But that's part of priestly fraternity is also fraternal correction. So if there's a neighboring priest who's not doing his job, I owe it to him in priestly charity to say, hey, is there something going on? Can I help you? And then if he says, mind your own business, then I can report it to, but instead of going directly to the vicar general or the dean or the bishop, but I don't think there's a mechanism here. And I think bishops are more reticent to correct each other or to even give that guidance, which I think, you know, if I as a priest need to do it, and you do the same in your walk of life too, that if there's someone at your business,
absolutely,
you would feel morally obligated to say, hey, you know, I need to point this out to you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's why this is such a funny thing. Are they afraid of one another? Are they afraid of Rome? I mean, do they live in fear?
I think there's apprehension. I wouldn't say fear, but I think there's apprehension because as we've seen, like with the recent Bishop Hawley, you know.
Yeah, in Memphis.
In Memphis, right. That there's been consequences. Now, I don't know all the details of the case involved, but some bishops have seen how some other bishops have been treated or how they've been penalized, maybe justifiably so, I don't know.
Right, right.
But that sets the tone when you see some guys, you know, are given a reprimand that's more than just a verbal. They start to say to themselves, well, I better be careful.
Yeah.
Because if I rock the boat, you know, I might be thrown off the boat. But again, here's where you get into the area of prudential judgments. And I think there's nothing wrong with the bishops as a body respectfully saying to Rome, you know, here's our concerns. This is how it's playing over here in the United States. We need to, we're asking you respectfully to, you know, reconsider, which I think they need to. I don't want them to, and I don't think they would ever do this, start to try to bully Rome and say, well, we're going to hold back Peter's pence, or we're going to, because then that's what the Anglican bishops did at the time of Henry VIII, you know, they split and said, well, we're going to make our own church. That's never a fear here.
Right.
But I do think they need to...
America's really been a very faithful country, hasn't it?
The most faithful. Of all the countries, we're the most faithful to the Holy See, even though we get the bad rep.
Right, right. Hold it there, Father. We'll come back and continue conversation. My guest, Father John Trigilio, who you know from his great work over the last 20 years on Web of Faith. He also serves as president of the Congregation of Catholic Clergy. He's director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary's Seminary and serves as a priest of the Diocese of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I'm Al Cresta. We'll be right back.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the most famous saints of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Augustine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, but he balanced his genius with humility. Once declared, it was pride that changed angels into devils. It is humility that makes men as angels. He died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruise, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net.
Discover what others say about Franciscan University of Steubenville. Forbes ranks Franciscan University in the top 10% of all U.S. colleges. U.S. News and World Report puts Franciscan in the top tier of Midwest colleges. And the Cardinal Newman Society says Franciscan University provides a faithful Catholic education. Discover a university that is academically excellent and passionately Catholic. Discover Franciscan University of Steubenville. Find out more at franciscan.edu.
This is a message to men. Men need fellowship and camaraderie. We may not admit it, but we do. The spousal relationship, of course, is number one. But there's an ongoing need men have to be in the company of men, especially if the man didn't have the benefit of a good dad. The fact is that men thrive best as men in the context of strong friendships with others, particularly the friendship with the ultimate man's man, our Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus is not Barney. He's not Mr. Rogers. He's the God of the universe. And while our gender-bending culture is literally insane on this, men learn what it means to be a man from their fathers and later from other men, not so much from their mothers and not from other women. This camaraderie, brothers, is not coming after you. You have to go after it. You have to choose it. You have to find it. This is Patrick Coffin at patrickcoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
How best to express ourselves to God? Our prayer takes flesh, says the Catholic Catechism, when we use mental or vocal words to talk to God, who speaks to us through His Word. Our heart must be involved in prayer. We must be present to Him whom we are addressing. Whether or not our prayer is heard depends not on the number of our words, says St. John Chrysostom, as the fervor of our souls. Vocal prayer is essential to the Christian life. Jesus taught the perfect vocal prayer, the Our Father, to His disciples. He prayed aloud the liturgical prayers in the synagogue. He also prayed aloud personally, exultantly praising the Father, as well as expressing His agony in Gethsemane. Vocal prayer fits the needs of our human nature. We are body and spirit, and this need corresponds to a divine requirement. God seeks worshipers in truth and spirit. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Father John Trigilio, Director of Pastoral Formation at Mount St. Mary's Seminary and President of the Confraternity of Catholic Clergy. I guess, tell me how you explain the abuse crisis. I mean, you obviously had to think about it. So yes, we're going back. We've got the big thing that happened in 2002. Mm-hmm. We all know, though, mid-1980s, there were reports in the news.
Well,
in the early 90s.
I was in the seminary in the late 70s or 80s.
Okay.
So I was in for 12 years, and I saw horrible things in seminary life.
Okay. Other friends of mine have said the same thing,
yeah.
Priests. How did you make sense of that at that time? Because that's got to be shocking.
Oh, it is. It is. And, you know, because it was so against what you hold and cherish that you were saying to yourself, no, this can't be. You know, you were in self-denial.
That's the first thing that happened.
Yes, exactly. Because you said this is just too, I mean, whether, and I remind people, it's the sex scandal is certainly the most serious and most urgent. But it is also, there's sort of like, it's a demonic triad from my nice standpoint. There's bad morality, which is most evident in the abuse of children and teenagers, mm-hmm. and the homosexual behavior of clergymen. But then there's also the liturgical abuses that took place and are taking place. And then you've got the dissident theology. And all three feed each other.
Isn't that
so? If you only deal with one, it's never going to be you're not going to find a solution. You need to address all three issues because lex orandi, lex credendi, lex vivendi.
Yeah.
So they're all connected.
This
right?
is all infidelity.
Yes, exactly.
These three areas are all.
And it's no accident that a lot of this took place, not exclusively, but a lot of it right after Humani Vitae, when the dissidents came out and priests and college professors and seminary people disputed Humani Vitae and
yes.
Pope Paul VI's authority. And once you reject a doctrine, it's easy to reject a moral precept.
Right, right. So, and they were given more liberty to do that than they should have, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. There was no real oversight. And then when finally they decided to look into the seminary life, the first one was, quote, a visitation, which...
Was that the early 80s?
Yes, that was... Yeah. I was still in the seminary when they said, oh, there's going to be a visitation. And we all had high expectations. We said, oh, great, they're going to clean it up.
That's okay.
And then we were told, no, this is a visitation, not an investigation.
Oh.
And later then, after I got ordained, I saw that that finally came to be where there was an investigation. And, yeah. Seminaries were told, you must teach... And of course, you had the catechism in 92. When I was ordained in 88, there was no catechism.
Right.
So you had no way of saying to a professor, wait a minute, you're going against Catholic teaching, because all you could quote was the Summa or even Vatican II. And they said, well,
or we're past hold up
that.
Father Hardin's catechism or something.
Well, you weren't allowed to have that.
You didn't even know that.
You
got to
hide that. But I'll tell you, it's things like Opus Dei was a big help to me because we had these seminars for seminarians. The Confraternity of Catholic Clergy I belonged to when I was a seminarian, and just having a good, solid priest like the late Father Bob Levis, who was my mentor.
Okay.
And then having good priest friends from seminary days keeps you grounded.
Yeah.
Because if you get a little kooky or weird, they say, hey, you know, you're wandering off the reservation. You need to get back here.
Yeah. You know, this is lay people really want to understand what happened, at least late people of my generation, who, you know, I came, returned to the church in 92, so I was away from the time I was around 14, so 1965 or so. And trying to understand what happened, well, you've got one of the things that attracted me back to the Catholic Church was clarity of teaching, the sacramentality, you know, liturgy. All these things, I ended up resigning my pastorate because I thought the Catholic Church embodied what I had been learning from Scripture. And then once I could return, I was surprised that what I was enthusiastic over, the majority of clergy that I met were not enthusiastic about.
Yeah,
you know, I was introduced to some very good people, and they helped. But it was that idea that, what's wrong here? So we know what the church teaches. And then when the catechism came out, I talked to the doctrinal authority in this particular diocese that I was in at the time. And I was enthused, and I went to breakfast with him. And I said, tell me, you know, what's it like? He said, oh, same old thing. the first universal catechism we've had.
Oh, I remember being so excited about it.
Yeah.
Because the Code of Canon Law, the revised code, came out in 83.
Right.
I was in the seminary. We're all going, yay, we're happy about that. And then when the catechism came out, I was already ordained, and we were going, yay. I remember Father Levis had to review the French edition.
Yes.
And there was so much excitement because we said, oh, we wish we would have had this in the seminary. Because all we had were papal encyclicals that were, they were dismissed very casually. There was the Vatican Council, ironically, would be the spirit of Vatican II was always shoved down our throats, but we weren't allowed to read the actual documents of Vatican II,
lest
you find something in there, you know. But I think a lot of my colleagues from the time I was in the seminary, some of them went to seminaries that were not up to snuff, and so they got some bad formation, either dissident theology, or they were exposed to aberrant liturgies, or actually some immoral activity, and that has a bearing, because then later years, there's almost like walking time bombs, and a lot of these guys were unaware of, because they were going in the seminary like a tabula rasa, clean slate, and they didn't realize. Now, today we've got, I'd say the majority of seminaries are much better. The one I'm at, I think, is one of the best.
Yeah. My son-in-law teaches there.
Yes, so all the more reason, you know. But there's this commitment to orthodoxy, but also to spirituality, you know. And there's these four dimensions that are mentioned from Pastores Dabo Vobis. Mm-hmm. You know, there's intellectual, there's human, there's pastoral, and there's spiritual. And we treat all four equally.
Yeah.
And that's why bishops say, I want normal guys. I want guys who are orthodox, who are prayerful, and are normal, okay? We're tired of the oddballs out there, and I think we could extend that higher up the food chain, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I do. I do know what you mean. Well, what happened? It seems to me, if I understand it correctly, what happens is back in the 70s, there's some bad formation. People get ordained, and they begin doing their work. Some of them become bishops. later on, when people begin to stand up and say, wait a minute, that's not the way it's supposed to be, mm-hmm. they're incensed because they've been doing this this way all along. Who are you to challenge me?
Exactly. And sometimes they might honestly believe that their position is the church's position.
And it's the future, too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the church of the future.
And you say, but wait a minute, now you've got a benchmark. We've got the catechism. We've got the code of canon law. Those are things which we didn't have when I was in the seminary. So you could say, that's what you need to compare it against. And we've got writings of wonderful popes of recent time, mm-hmm. Which before you had things which were a little bit, I wouldn't say arcane, but they dealt with former ages.
Yes, yes.
So that if you read an encyclical of Leo XIII, it's still valid today. But we got stuff today like, the Pope John Paul's Theology of the Body,
right.
Which is a big help for me as a priest to explain the church's teaching on sexuality. But again, when I was in the seminary, we didn't have that. So we had professors who were teaching us Hans Kung, and there you got your phone right there.
Pope John Paul II's post-synodal apostolic exhortations,
that
bound volume.
Gold. It's worth gold. But we had like Hans Kung, Skillebecks, all these, the usual characters that we were being taught, not just that it's good for the guys to be exposed to know what the opposition is saying, but we were given it as if this was the gospel, the dissident theology. And again, it was backed up by the bizarre liturgies, where things were treated in a very irreverent manner. And then, of course, you've got the bad behavior going on later on in the evening. So it all made sense that these were connected, but nobody wanted to see that.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard it said that if a bishop disciplined, it dealt with doctrinal infidelity, moral infidelity, insensitive pastoring, that he'd have no more priests. I think that's a gross exaggeration.
Yeah.
But my point is, the lady that I speak to believe that if we had to meet once a month in U of M Stadium to receive the Eucharist, and we have the Vatican through the week,
uh-huh.
We'd be fine. As long as we had priests, we were confident in. And I also think that in one generation, young men would begin to see what real priests were like. Talk to me about the difficulty bishops have in this concern. One of their responsibilities is to make sure the sacrament's available.
Yes.
So obviously they have to make prudential judgments. Mm-hmm. There may be a priest they're not especially keen on, but if I get rid of him, it's going to make the sacraments less available.
Yes, yes.
Talk to me about the thinking there and the degree to which, I'm not talking about a super rigorous thing, but...
Go back in church history and remember just prior to the Reformation, one of the reasons why the Reformation became possible was that there was a climate, because right after the Black Death decimated, you had one-fourth of the laity, but two-thirds of the clergy were killed by the plague because priests were anointing people
who
were infested.
That's right, they were out there, yeah.
So when two-thirds of the clergy are wiped out, they were not too picky on who they ordained.
Yes.
There was no formation. If the guy was breathing, you slapped hands on him and ordained him, because people needed the sacraments.
Right.
And then Trent said, this is what got us into trouble, because then you had poorly trained priests who were saying bizarre things and acting badly.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of precipitated the trouble that they had. So Trent said, no, we need seminaries to give these guys a good foundation so that this would not happen again. And things worked out fine. But then, like I said, with... Humanae Vitae and the dissent against it, here's where the crack started to happen. And in fact, the seminaries were under the Congregation for Education for a long time. Now it's under Congregation for Clergy, where it belongs. And you need oversight by the bishop and by Rome to make sure the seminaries are doing what they're doing. So I'm so happy to be at Mount St. Mary's because they go by the book.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think there's, and then the guys we have, I see the guys who are getting ordained today, they have great potential. So I think people need to know that the priests that are coming out now, they're not perfect, but they're better prepared in many ways than I think that we were. I mean, I was lucky to have some auxiliary help and that. But the guys are getting good foundation. But I can see what you're saying. Like, bishops, they get worried because there's what they call the domino effect. If you remove a pastor, then you got to replace him with somebody else.
Right.
And if you start removing too many, who fills the gaps?
Right.
Or when
right.
you start closing parishes, and it's not an envious position to be in, but I think the people's right to valid sacraments and Orthodox doctrine, but also that their priests are behaving and are hopefully living good lives, that should be the most tantamount.
Yeah.
And if it means priests, you know, if there might be some inconvenience either from the diocesan level or even from the parochial level, it's better that than we take the chance and put somebody who's not just mediocre, but sub-adequate.
Very good. Father, seminary education is much stronger today than it was in the 1970s.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I think we can be quite pleased with.
Yes. So.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Al.
Yeah. Father John Trujillo, again, he's president of the Confraternity Catholic Clergy, director of pastoral formation at Mount St. Mary's, and a priest of the Diocese of Harrisburg. You hear him regularly on Web of Faith.
It's time to take control of your healthcare journey and experience healthcare fully alive with CMF Curo. Krista and Justin say,
we love having the understanding, decision-making, and control of our healthcare in our own hands and having the option to bear one another's burdens. But most importantly, we love helping others when they need medical support.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry that values the health of the whole person, spirit, mind, and body.
To experience healthcare fully alive for you and your family, visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical. And in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong or hurtful, something that needs corrected. Most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being with me today. I'm Al Cresta. Do follow up on our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Check out our resource page where we've published what we, the laity, are reading that is shaking us to the core. A group that I'm a member of, No More Victims, is handing this out to all the bishops here in Baltimore, and we'd also like you to see it. It's a 32-page reader. Some very good material in it, and you can get it at AveMariaRadio.net. It should be right there in our slider on the front page, also on the resource page. Now, tomorrow we'll be back, continuing to cover the annual Fall Assembly of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops here in Baltimore, Maryland. The big focus, of course, is the abuse crisis, but there are other items which we will get to tomorrow. Thanks for being with me today. Keep the bishops in your prayers. Keep all of us in your prayers. And let's hope that the body of Christ will radiate the holiness that we see in the crucified and resurrected Jesus.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. The executive producer is Nick Tom. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AVEMARIA, radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.